I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. I am indebted to the volunteer firefighters in my town who many years ago put out a kitchen fire that I had set when I stupidly left hot oil cooking on the stove and walked away. Before long, my kitchen was engulfed in flames that was carefully and expertly extinguished by my fire company, my neighbors. The country's first volunteer fire company was organized in Philadelphia in the late 18th century, thanks to Benjamin Franklin. Today, Pennsylvania and most other states are facing a serious shortage in volunteer firefighters. In the last 40 years, the Commonwealth has lost an astonishing 80% of its volunteer force. Today in Radio Times, how did this happen, what to do about it, and what is life like for a volunteer firefighter? We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Bill Genoway is program director of the Firemen's Association of the State of Pennsylvania's Recruitment and Retention Program, also board president of the Congressional Fire Services Institute, former King of Prussia Fire Chief. Bill Genoway, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is George DeVault. He was a volunteer firefighter for 30 years in Lehigh County. That's in Pennsylvania from 1982 to 2012. Author of a new memoir called Fire Call, Sounding the Alarm to Save Our Vanishing Volunteers. George DeVault, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Marty. Thank you.
Let me begin with you, George, only because you wrote this book, and in this book you wrote that you were meant to be a firefighter. How come? How so?
A long series of things that happened throughout my life just steered me in that direction, from working for the newspaper in high school, working in newspapers later on, and my teachers, my mentors at the time were all volunteers. They put out a garage fire in my parents' house, and when we moved to a town that had an all-volunteer fire department, it just seemed the most natural thing in the world to do.
Part of it is a community service, I guess, feeling part of the community, and I'm assuming also the excitement of trying to put out a fire.
Absolutely. They both go together. But the biggest part was helping out the community. I'd been a spectator on the sidelines as a reporter, photographer for years, and then it was time to become an active participant.
To you, Bill, how come you became a firefighter?
My parents were big into helping the community in any way that they could. My dad joined the local volunteer fire company when I was 7, and I tagged along. So when I became 16, it was time to join the volunteer fire company, and at which time he was one of the chief officers. So it was a natural for me. It was a social element as well as something that I ultimately was educated in, became a fire protection engineer, and just blossomed from there, if you will.
Is it a family thing? I mean, it seems that it runs in certain families.
That's true. It does. Now, it stopped with me and my family, so we're only a 2-generation, but I know 5- and 6-generation families that have participated in the fire service.
George, I'm curious about the kind of training that you had. This goes back to the 1980s. Seems like a long time ago. What was the early training for you to be a firefighter?
The early training was everything imaginable. In a small volunteer department, everyone does everything. You're not specialized. You do certain things on this truck and certain things on that truck. You have to be able to climb the aerial ladder in an air pack and direct a master stream, as well as take a hose line in on the ground floor of a burning building, do vehicle rescue, work with hazardous materials. It's everything from soup to nuts, because you never know what's going to happen when you go out on a fire call.
In fact, I was surprised to learn that firefighters rarely have to put out fires anymore, if I can put that to you, Bill, that most of the calls are non-fire related.
That's correct. Depending on how the organization is created and what their service demands are, they may spend 90% of their time on emergency medical services work or a significant amount of time handling automatic fire alarms. So it has changed. When I joined, it was before the day of the automatic fire alarm. In fact, the smoke detector wasn't invented until 1971, 72. So this is a 3 to 4 decade significant change, if you will, in what the expectations are of this service delivery system.
George, you do describe a number of experiences that you had as a firefighter. I mean, some of them seemed really scary and clearly very dangerous. And I'm wondering if you could just describe for our listeners what it's like to walk into a burning building.
Well, the first thing is you don't walk into it.
Okay.
People say, you know, firefighters, they run into burning buildings. We don't. Usually we crawl. The reason for that is to stay below as much of the heat and smoke as we possibly can so that we can do our job more safely. Believe it or not, safety is the one thing that's stressed in all the training we do, because if we get hurt trying to put out a fire, we only complicate the situation. We don't want to make things worse.
You're on the floor, then you're crawling through. I mean, how do you assess, how do you know what you're dealing with?
That's part of why we train constantly. We have weekly training classes in all the fire departments. We take night and weekend classes. We go through all kinds of simulations with flashovers, other problems that we can get into, so that we recognize the warning signs and hopefully keep our radar fine-tuned enough to recognize that in time and do something about it. Pull back if we have to, call for help, change tactics as things progress.
Well, I'm thinking about things like collapsing floors or collapsing walls or collapsing roofs. I mean, all these things.
Constantly have to be on guard for any and all of that, because conditions inside a burning building can change drastically in the blink of an eye.
Is that something you sort of learned to read over time, Bill?
It is.
Or is every fire different?
It is something that you do learn to read over time. But George makes a good point in his book where he talks about professional volunteers. And by that, he means that we no longer would simply jump on the back of a fire engine and ride to a fire and then try to do whatever we could to manage the problem. In today's world, certification at various levels is extremely important, whether you're a firefighter or a command officer. And understanding all of those significant events that occur during that continuum of fire that allow the officers to make decisions that can then bring their teams in, out, move them, et cetera.
And George, are you looking for, if you're in a building that is on fire, are you looking for the source of the fire? Is that the goal? I know that seems like kind of a dumb question.
Well, it's the ultimate goal to put the fire out.
Yes.
But you're looking for a lot of different things at the same time. If there's a person inside the building somewhere, you know, you're trying to find out where they are, assess the fire conditions, and constantly assess the risk to your hose team so that you don't get too far in there and run into big problems.
Where you can't get out.
Right.
You have to really rely then on your fellow firefighters.
Oh, absolutely. It's no joke when you talk about putting your life in your fellow firefighters' hands. It happens on every fire call.
You did this for 30 years. Were you ever injured? Were you ever hurt?
Not seriously. A few cuts and scrapes, minor burns. But I was very fortunate there.
How about when you were working with King of Prussia and some other?
The same. A few minor incidents, but nothing significant, fortunately.
What does that tell us, or what does that tell you?
Well, I think that the point that really needs to be made is in the last decade, there has been a significant shift to consider firefighter safety. And the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation has established the 16 life safety initiatives, which are essentially in every fire station, career or volunteer, as considerations that have to be made to make sure that we come back home safely. Because if we don't come back home safely, who's going to go out to put the fire out,
sure,
to serve the medical call, et cetera? So that has become an overriding cultural shift in the past decade that all firefighters and EMS personnel have to deal with.
You mentioned smoke detectors. I'm assuming there are different kinds of materials that are less flammable. Do we live in a safer environment when it comes to fires? I'm looking at you, Bill.
Well, there are scientists who will suggest that fires burn hotter and faster in today's environment because of the expanded use of various polymers, plastics, and so on. And they are right to a certain degree, which means that the fire gets hotter faster. We don't know that fires literally burn at a higher temperature than they did before, but there is a significant change in what's called the standard time of temperature curve, which means how fast a fire gets going. Uh-huh. That means that an intervention has to come faster to make sure that you can do things in a safer manner and put the fire out quicker and more and safer. So there are changes in the science of fire. A lot of testing in the past few years by NIST, the National Institute of Science and Technology, that is actually creating new thought processes on how to fight fires.
Anything you want to add to that, George, from your own experience?
No, he covered everything there, I think. You
described several instances. One, I mean, it seems like a really just tragic accident. There were two planes that crashed near your area in Lehigh County, up in just outside of Philadelphia. Can you describe that for our listeners? What happened?
This is back in the late 80s. Two small planes on a summer Sunday afternoon. The streets and malls are full of people. Mid-air collision over the main highway. And they came down in the shopping center parking lots. And what I describe in the book is what our volunteer fire companies did to take care of the aftermath. There were seven dead, a fire to put out. It was probably the hardest chapter in the book to write.
I can imagine.
Because there was very intense emotion involved in the whole thing. It's the kind of thing that people not close to that just never think of. And it hit very close to home because one of the victims was the same age, same size as my 12-year-old son. I had a hard time writing about that, but it's the kind of thing that people need to be aware of, I think.
Well, and I wonder, just picking up on that, Bill, whether with something like that, whether firefighters need some kind of, you know, debriefing or way of dealing with the upset over the trauma, having to deal so directly with people at risk.
Absolutely. And critical incident stress debriefing or stress management is a critical component today. When we started, they didn't have any thought that that was something you should consider. But in today's world, it has to be addressed, quickly.
Quickly, because I guess just the intensity of the experience.
The intensity, and the longer you allow those scenarios to continue without any type of talking about it or at least allowing yourself to grieve or relieve or whatever your response may be, the longer that is allowed to fester, then the bigger the problem becomes.
Are firefighters sort of willing to be vulnerable like that, George? Share some of their
yes and no.
Yes and no.
It's tough to open up about it. That's one thing that made writing the book more difficult. There's another chapter in there about the man who was stuck in the pond during Hurricane Floyd, and he went through. It was very traumatic emotionally for him, and he went through a lot of counseling after that. And one of the things his counselor was urging him to do was write down his thoughts and experiences. Write about it. He just finished reading the book and saw that incident from a totally different perspective.
From your perspective, right?
Right. And learned a lot of things about it that he never knew before. And he said it was very cathartic. It helped tremendously. And a lot of research has been done recently that would benefit firefighters where it says that it is helpful, like an incident stress debriefing, to write down your thoughts and feelings. Get it out of your system so it doesn't linger and fester.
Well, we need to take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about being a volunteer firefighter in this hour of Radio Times. The voice you just heard is George DeVault. He spent 30 years as a firefighter in Lehigh County, Pennsylvania. He has a new book called Fire Call, Sounding the Alarm to Save Our Vanishing Volunteers. Also with us is William Genoway, Program Director of the Firemen's Association of the State of Pennsylvania's Recruitment and Retention Program. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with George DeVault and Bill Genoway about being a volunteer firefighter and getting some of the experiences that George has written about in his book called Fire Call. And if you have ever been a volunteer firefighter, considered it, or had the use of their services, as I have, we do want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And again, you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Bill, I wonder how many fires are just knuckleheads like me doing something stupid in a home and thereby calling the services of the volunteer fire company.
Actually, people are the number one cause.
That's what I kind of figured. Just because we're not thinking what we're doing, right?
Well, it's that, or you've created a situation that ultimately can have the three elements come together and the fire occurs, or the accident occurs. But yes, people are the first, second, and third causes of fire and EMS responses.
Are there times, George, when you wanted to say to someone, what were you thinking?
Naturally.
Naturally.
Naturally. But you have to restrain yourself because we do the same things too. You do something over and over and over again, you get used to it, you get careless, and boom, disaster strikes.
In fact, there was a fire in your garage.
There was. Funny you should mention
yes,
that.
Yes, I read about that. What happened in your garage?
The pipes froze up one January, and we were trying to keep them from refreezing. I got a little heater, an old extension cord that I thought was okay. And the next thing we know, the garage is full of smoke, and we have to call the fire department.
And did your fellow firefighters give you the look?
More than that.
You heard about that.
I still hear about that. But they rushed right out, dropped whatever they were doing. It was interesting because the mix of people we had on the truck, we had an insurance agent driving, a stay-at-home mom hop on the truck, a mechanic. Just that's the way volunteer fire departments work. The community stops what it's doing to help a neighbor.
And is that one of the reasons why there's a shortage in that people either don't have that sense of community feeling or perhaps they work 30 miles away, they can't drop what they're doing to go and put out a fire or go deal with an emergency, Bill?
Yes and more. George very succinctly brings out in his book that the times have changed. And because of that, the disposable time that people had in the 50s, 60s, and 70s isn't available today. If you stop and think about how many sports your kids played in the 50s or you played in the 50s, 60s, and 70s compared to the opportunities that they have today, they're immense today. And as a result of that, if you are taking kids to do that, if you're involved in managing what they do, or if you have to travel an hour one way to work it back, your disposable time is gone. So what we have to do in public safety services is understand that paradigm shift has occurred, and then we have to take a look at how to make today's culture fit the volunteer system. And that's a very difficult transition. George mentions dinosaurs in his book.
He does.
And really, the dinosaur concept is we can't look at things the way we did 20 years ago and 30 years ago. It's a whole new world, and this is no different.
But you need firefighters who are available to deal with emergencies. I mean, that doesn't change.
And you need them, and you need to have a system that's flexible enough that it allows people to deal to respond to emergencies when they have the opportunity to take shifts, to take evenings versus daytimes. There's a lot of ways to do it. But when we joined, the goal was to make every fire call.
Oh, absolutely.
You can't do that today. You have to take what's a reasonable amount of participation and then get people to work into that reasonable amount of participation.
You want to add to that, George? I mean, this is part of what you write about.
Yeah. Well, Bill's talking about 30, 40 years ago. A lot of people worked at home in our fire companies. It's a rural area in Lehigh County. We had a lot of farmers, people who lived there, worked there. When the fire siren went, they dropped everything and ran. I still work at home as a farmer and was responding to daytime calls. But anytime you get a weekday call, from a personnel standpoint, you have problems.
You just don't have enough personnel.
If you're lucky, you have someone to drive the truck. Hopefully, you have a few more firefighters to climb on board. But one example I talk about in the book, we've got a raging house fire in a neighboring fire district with a report of a woman trapped inside. We're responding on our first truck with a crew of two, something you don't want to do, but sometimes you have to. There just aren't enough people to go around.
Well, our community's thinking instead of relying on volunteers, we need to hire people and pay them, Bill? Well, let me toss it first to you, Bill, then to George.
That is an option. There's no doubt about it. There's also the whole concept of consolidation that has raised as an issue in the past few years, where multiple fire companies, particularly if they're close together, can pool their staffing and as a result can then have enough personnel rather than doing it individually. Mm-hmm. There are some solutions that we've seen around the country that work, but it's incumbent upon the local leadership to make that change happen and allow for those changes to occur.
You want to add to that, George?
Yes, one thing we're doing different places around the country is having standby drivers paid to stay at the station so that you're assured of having a driver. Also in our township, this is something we're talking about now with our two fire companies, is having township employees, public works employees, also belong to the fire company. And when there is a fire call, they drop what they're doing and respond to the firehouse. It's okay with the township. It's why the township's in business. There, as Bill said, there are a lot of things you can do.
Does every township need a big hook and ladder and you know, all the equipment that one sees in firehouses?
In theory, no, they don't. However, when one looks at what insurance requirements are for a municipality, then you have to make sure that those types of resources are available. Now, in recent years, they've changed how this can be evaluated, and no longer does one community have to have all of those assets. They can rely on automatic aid from neighboring towns, but it's still someone has to lead, figure it out, make the changes, and so on. So I think you can get my trend here is leadership is a big deal. And if you don't have a leader, that doesn't mean they have to do everything, but they have to know who they can bring in to handle various aspects. One person can't do it all.
You were saying an interesting thing before we went on the air, Bill, about the fact that I guess at your firehouse, there are some college students who actually can live there, attend college, but also be part of, I guess, part of the force, right?
That's correct. And that is –
Is that unusual?
No, it really isn't. It's a practice that I know personally dates back to the 50s and the 60s in Stillwater, Oklahoma and College Park, Maryland, where students could come and they had fire protection programs there at those universities. But you stayed in the college fire station,
right,
and you ran the calls and you got your board for free and or your room for free. That now has proliferated around the United States. And even in Pennsylvania, if you look at central Pennsylvania, there are at least a dozen fire stations there that have this kind of program. Mm-hmm. There are a number here in our region in southeastern PA. When you go into Maryland, they are everywhere.
Oh, interesting. Let me reintroduce the two of you. And that's Bill Genoway. He's program director of the Firemen's Association of the State of Pennsylvania's Recruitment and Retention Program. And Pennsylvania, like other states, is facing a volunteer firefighter shortage. He's also board president of the Congressional Fire Services Institute, former King of Prussia fire chief. George DeVault is with us as well. He was a volunteer firefighter for 30 years in Lehigh County. That's just north of Philadelphia. That was from 1982 to 2012. And again, the author of a new book. It's a memoir. It's also a bit of a history as well, called Fire Call, Sounding the Alarm to Save Our Vanishing Volunteers. We have some calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Questions, comments, stories related to volunteer firefighters or firefighting. Let me get, looks like Doug from Bucks County to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Doug. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Marty.
Hi there.
My question is, are there opportunities for senior citizens who are no longer physically able to handle the demands of fighting a fire to volunteer in a meaningful way for their local fire departments?
Is there room for senior citizens?
Absolutely. There's room for everybody, and this is one point I make in the book. In the back of it, I've got a list of non-firefighting jobs that people throughout the community can perform, everything from grant writing to mowing the grass to helping with mechanical needs, taking care of the buildings. Firefighters traditionally try to do everything themselves.
Oh, yeah?
And that's part of the problem. They don't like to ask for help. But there's a lot of people out there in the community who are ready, willing, and able to help. You just have to knock on the firehouse door and say, can I come in too?
And why are they reluctant to ask for help? Is it just sort of feeling overly responsible for everything?
It's not the nature of the beast.
You agree? You're nodding your head.
I agree 100%. And I would just suggest that if anyone has skills or knowledge sets that they think might be of value to the volunteer fire company or ambulance squad, just go knock on the door and say, hey, I have a background in accounting. I have a background in finance. I have a background in marketing. I have a background in engineering. Absolutely.
And how much of volunteer firefighting time is taken up with things like fundraising?
Too much.
Too much. This is you, Bill.
In today's world, too much. There are a couple of reasons for this. One is the cost of everything has gone up over time. And it seems like you can buy an axe in any one of the big box stores and buy that axe for $5. But if it's a fire axe, it's $50.
Oh, is that right? If it has the word fire
well,
on it?
Well, I don't know if it's that or if it's because they have to make it a little bit more. But it just seems that we have a higher expense level for sure than we did 25 years ago. And as a result of that, it just requires the departments to go out and earn more money. And the municipalities, particularly the smaller ones and the rural ones, they can't afford those significant assets.
So what is it, bake sales and phone banks and things like that?
Hoagie sales.
You can think of.
Spaghetti dinners. Right.
But can you run a fire company on spaghetti dinners and hoagie sales?
It's getting tougher every day. People who have who are chefs, caterers, could be a tremendous help to a fire company to take over the Sunday morning pancake breakfast or the spaghetti dinners. There's so many possibilities for that.
But that may pay for the electric bill for that month. The amount of money that you earn as profit from a bake sale or a breakfast. How do you then pay for the hose that you have to buy? How do you pay for the building mortgage? How do you pay for the fire engine or the ambulance?
What does a fire engine cost? I mean, you know, a well-equipped one, good-sized one.
$500,000 is a reasonable number today.
Wow. And do they last decades, or is there – do you feel like you need to get one every decade or so? Or
depends on use.
Yeah.
Maintenance. You know, a truck that runs 300 calls a year might get a longer lifespan than one that runs 900 runs a year.
You wrote in your book, George, that you liked riding the tailboard.
Absolutely. It's great fun.
And that's on the side? That's the side of the
– That's the rear of the
truck.
Oh,
that's the rear. Okay.
Yeah, the rear step with safety belts. But still, even with that, there were too many problems. People fall off and get hurt. So we don't do that anymore. Haven't for a long time.
But you used to enjoy it?
It was great fun.
Just the sort of feeling
Except in cold winter weather.
Right. But just the sort of wind in your face and being on the back of a fire engine.
Right.
George has some great photos in his book about parades and what I call the era that's gone by. And I think what we have to remember is that the fire department of today is not our father's or our grandfather's fire department. It is the fire department of the 21st century that has totally different performance expectations, financial demands, and personnel requirements than we did 40 years ago. It's a new game.
There's a poster in your book, George. It's from Emmaus in Pennsylvania, and it's a picture or a drawing, I guess, of some fireman's boots, and it says, "If not you, who?"
Very good question.
I mean, still very relevant today, I guess.
More so than ever, because, as you said, we've lost 80% of our volunteers in the state in the last 40 years, and that makes a tough job much more difficult.
But it seems to me that if we don't have enough volunteer firefighters and we are dependent on them to keep us safe, are we not sort of at a risk of being in a serious situation, Bill? Or maybe we are.
We are. We are at a serious situation. If it takes 25 minutes for a fire engine to get to your kitchen fire, it's much more than a kitchen fire. So there are benchmarks, I guess is the best way to put it, that have been established recently that are forcing a different look at this delivery model or business model of the volunteer fire department. But it goes to the career departments too. Mm. The people's expectations have changed, particularly as more people who lived in city environments where there were career fire departments moved to the suburbs or to the rural areas. They have a different expectation of the fire companies and the ambulance squads. And those new expectations are forcing the fire departments to look at things differently.
Let me see what Harry from Ardmore has to say. Harry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
I'm a relatively recent volunteer firefighter. Bill was actually the speaker at my firefighter certification graduation ceremony last year. And I wanted to ask a question for Bill. If you were starting from scratch, how would you design your recruitment efforts? Hmm. You know, ignoring the 100 plus years of history with the fire companies in the area. I recently been getting involved with the recruitment efforts in my township. How would you redesign recruitment efforts? What are some innovative solutions to this recruitment problem that you would?
Well, the first thing,
thanks, Harry. Yeah, go ahead.
That's
go
a great ahead. Great discussion point, and congratulations on your certification. And I had a great time that night. I think that the one thing that I've learned in doing this project for the Firemen's Association is that the current leadership of fire departments needs to get a different perspective. And what I've seen work in a number of places is going to a local business and asking them to allow someone from the business to participate and help you design a recruiting program, help you go out and actually recruit people. So we're talking about a marketing person or a human resource person or someone who is very, very successful in going out into the public and helping that organization. Have them learn a little bit about the fire department and then let them go sell you. And when they go out and sell you, you now have an advocate that's not one of you, and then they're able to present a totally different perspective. I can also tell you that when we did the strategic plan for the state of Pennsylvania, we found – without question, the number one way to get new people is for everyone to go out and get one. So those old programs that we saw as part of membership groups where go out and get one of your peers, that is by far the most successful system that we saw, not only in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, but around the country.
We're almost up on a break here, but retention, George, I'm assuming that's the other part of the puzzle, right?
It's critical because you want to keep all the good people you have in addition to get new people in.
And keep them busy, keep them happy, keep them learning.
Keep them motivated. Be sure and thank them for everything they do. They're not just cheap labor that can be taken for granted. You know, that's a problem in some departments. Everything's and everybody's just taken for granted. Management style and leadership are key to all of this.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's George DeVault, and a former volunteer firefighter, did that for 30 years, and he's written a book about it called Fire Call. Also with us is William Genoway. He's program director of the Firemen's Association of the State of Pennsylvania's Recruitment and Retention Program. We are talking about some of the challenges of being a volunteer firefighter today. And the phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with George DeVault and Bill Genoway about volunteer firefighters. And we've got some callers I want to get in. We also have a comment from Jose. He says, it sounds like the problem fire departments have is that people in the community don't understand the value of the service until they really need it. And back to you, George, because you talked about people feeling appreciated.
Yeah,
the importance of feeling appreciated.
One of the main reasons I wrote the book. Because people I've known all my life, who've known me all my working life, they knew I was a volunteer firefighter, but never gave it a second thought. They just took it all for granted, had absolutely no idea what's really involved in volunteering. And that, as much as anything, is why I wrote the book, is to open their eyes to what's going on, to what these men and women really do, and why the community needs to get behind them more than ever.
You did this for 30 years. Was there a reason that you retired from volunteer firefighting?
Well, I joined the fire service late. I was 31 when I joined, which isn't old for a new recruit. Most people get into it, like Bill, in their teens or younger. I stuck with it for 30 years. My wife and I are both in our 60s now, and I felt I owed my wife a life in our golden years. The best thing I could do was write about it, tell people what's going on.
And was that satisfying to you to put this all down? As you said, this is sort of
tremendously. It was
30 years in the making.
Very, very cathartic for me, too.
What do you look for in a recruit? I mean, what kinds of skills do you look for, Bill?
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because one of the research items we found is that you should be identifying that. You, the fire department or ambulance squad, should be identifying all the skills and knowledge sets that you want in your organization to fill whatever the needs may be. If you want someone that's simply going to be a responder to emergencies, they have X skill sets and knowledge sets, and you may have to train them. But motivation, interest is the number one factor. I remember the last time our high school had a volunteer fair, we had 19 students sign up that had an interest in being a volunteer. They had different interests. Some wanted to really be volunteer fire and EMS persons. Others wanted some community service activity to get onto their resume for college. So you have to match what your skill and knowledge needs are with what the interests of the young people are, or the older people too.
You have to look out or watch out for people that are either sort of too macho to be a firefighter, or even those kind of fire bugs, people that are attracted to actually setting fires and then being a firefighter?
Well, today, anyone who does not conduct background checks on any new candidate, regardless of their potential role, is making a big mistake. You need to do those on multiple levels, and that's a standard practice for most fire departments. But yes, you have to manage the person when they come in, and that's why they need a mentor. When they come in, they need to have probationary requirements, and they need to be able to meet certain steps, if you will.
George, you mentioned a woman on I guess part of your fire company in Lehigh County. Is it unusual to see a woman firefighter these days?
Not at all. There are more and more, and they perform wonderfully well. All of the women I've ever fought fires with, I can't say enough good about them.
You agree with that?
Absolutely. I still remember one call that we had in the middle of the night, and it was the driver, myself was the officer, and two female firefighters, and it was a second floor of an old mansion on the main line, and they went in and knocked the fire down and did a great job.
Let me get to – looks like John from Upper Providence to join us on Radio Times. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. First of all, George, I'd like to agree with you. I'm an active volunteer, not quite as old as you, but close enough. But the tailboard riding was still one of the great thrills. It was definitely a perk. I've had the privilege of serving with Dr. Genoway in Upper Marion Township and watching the cycle of the fire service move through. And I think one of the greatest challenges we're facing now is that when we bring in new folks, regardless of their age, from the first time they knock on the door at the firehouse, it's easily 18 months to 2 years before that individual attains the training and certification to be what I would call a road-ready fireman. And that's really the challenge. And, I hate to say it, but it's a dinosaur expression. Back in the day, you join up, they set you up with a set of boots and a coat and a hat and point you to the back of the truck. Say, get on and hold on and you got on-the-job training in addition to some schools that are not nearly as thorough or intense as the current levels of training are. And really, that long lead time, even if we were to have an influx of folks at my station today, it's, as I said, 18 months to 2 years till they're ready to go.
Well, John, let me toss your comment first to Bill and then to George.
John's absolutely right. It may take that long. There are some considerations being made about modifying some of the training to allow you to do different things earlier in that cycle of 2 years. But the reality is the requirements today are much more stringent than they were when George and I were back in the day.
And back in the day, George, I mean, really, was it when you first became a volunteer firefighter, basically said, here are your boots, here's your coat, and here's the hose?
Not quite, but close.
Really?
Yeah, I went through a six-month probation training period before I could actually respond to fire calls. But the training we had in the meantime was engaging enough that it kept people interested, motivated. There's a lot you can do with modifying your training, and it comes back again to leadership and having a good training officer to keep everybody excited and engaged.
But is sort of fighting an actual fire, is that in many ways that's almost like the best training you get because there's nothing like a real fire?
That's as good as it gets.
And you have to rely on your knowledge and your fellow firefighters.
Your fellow firefighters, your more experienced people who are leading the hose team. Keep you from doing dumb things. You have to work together.
And what's a dumb thing? What would be a dumb thing?
Oh, getting to the house and immediately opening all the doors and windows and letting air in. Oh. The fire will just take off and explode.
So don't do that.
No.
No, and if you have, I guess if you have a fire in your house, close doors, close windows.
Right.
If you can.
When my garage caught fire, the fire chief after it was all over, he says, "I'm glad it was your house." I said, "Thanks, pal." He says, "No, I mean that. Anybody else would have put the garage door up to let the smoke out, and by the time we got there, the flames would have been through the roof." You know, smother it, contain it as much as you can.
We have looks like Bree from Allentown joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Bree. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I love
sure.
your show.
Oh, thank you.
So I was actually a volunteer EMS person in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, before starting the physician assistant school. And it was an incredible experience. It absolutely was really formative to my career. And it was great. I wouldn't trade that time for anything. In Montgomery County, fire and EMS are in one station. So you can join up as a volunteer. You get all the training you can ask for free. And all they ask for is one week night a week. And I think it's every third or fourth weekend. So I think it's a great opportunity for people that are looking to get into the medical field. And, I just want to say thanks very much for everyone that continues to do it. It's a lot of time and a lot of commitment, but it's really worth it.
Well, thank you for calling in and for what you do as well. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, Bree, thank you for calling in because you raise a great point. The fact that many people who want to learn skills can learn a great deal by being either a fire EMS person. Your medical interests, clearly, anyone who wants to be a nurse or anything in the medical field, physician's assistant, to be able to ride on an ambulance and see those kinds of problems firsthand is an immense learning experience. But firefighters, if you have interest in plumbing, HVAC, electrical, engineering, construction, firefighting or fire engineering, all of those types of job opportunities will be have a valuable learning experience in a volunteer fire department. So I would always tell students when I got the chance to talk to them, if you have any one of these types of interests, join the fire department because you're going to learn a lot in a very short period of time.
Bree, thanks for the call. We have an email from Pete. He says, do fire departments reach out to young veterans? It seems like it would be a good fit. I guess I'm back to you, Bill. Is that an effort?
He makes a point that we need to understand. Most volunteer fire departments don't do a lot of reaching out in the traditional sense. And I was at one fire station where the chief said, if someone comes knocking on our door, we'll take them because then we know they have an interest. And if you want to go out and compete against all of those individuals who have opportunities to work at nursing homes or libraries or YMCAs and get on the list, you have to go out and compete. So the fire departments should be out recruiting and talking to veterans. They are a great resource. And we could do, I can't think of any better ones. I think of the guys and gals that we've had in our department over the years that have served. They come with an understanding, a mindset of how to deal with emergencies and problems.
George, it's been a couple of years since you retired. Do you miss it?
Every day.
Every day, really? I mean, you have that kind of hankering?
Every time the fire siren goes off, we can hear it a mile away from the firehouse. You know, I always wonder, who's on the truck? What's going on? Could they use some help?
Do you go down and hang out at the firehouse?
Not too much.
Not too much. Just because you're kind of moving on with the next chapter in your life?
Right.
Let me see what Mike from Marlton has to say. Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Yes, I have a quick comment and a quick question.
Sure.
The comment is, first of all, I had the great opportunity to work years ago with Bill Genoway at the same insurance
You're
company.
You're quite famous, Bill, when it comes to the firefighting world. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes. With that company about 12 years ago, I had the opportunity to create a promotion where we took 33 New York City firefighters to New Zealand and met their counterparts in New Zealand. And I met firefighters from other countries as well. And the one thing you find is they have a very common type of psychology among all of them. They're all some of the greatest, most responsible, dedicated people I've ever met. And they were just the type of personality that would run into I know you don't run into a burning building, but use that expression. They were the type of person that was more than willing to do that to save somebody that they never even met before. So that was a wonderful experience. The question I have is, with volunteer fire companies, as I understand it, when the alarm sounds, the volunteer has to drop what he or she is doing and get to the fire station and then get out on the truck and go to the call. Is there valuable time lost because the travel time could be almost doubled as opposed to having, let's say, a completely professional staff already at the fire station?
Well, I'm going to toss that to Bill. Go ahead.
That's a great question, Mike. Good to hear from you. Always good to hear from some old colleagues. What we see happening around the country today are the benchmarks that are being established so that a community adopts a standard of response cover which says we will have a unit with four people or five people or three people. It varies by community. We'll have that unit on scene within X number of minutes, X percentage of the time. So a number of years back in King of Prussia, we had the business model established where we will have a unit on scene with four people in 9 minutes, 90% of the time. And the last I looked, which was 2 years ago, we were at 97% to the benchmark. So if you establish it and you know that it works, that's what the International City Managers Association is looking for. That's what the Fire Chiefs Association is looking for. And that's what the accreditation models are now looking at.
Who are some famous firefighters we should know about, George?
You mean besides Ben Franklin and George Washington?
Yes, exactly.
Kurt Vonnegut was a firefighter.
I was surprised.
And you mentioned
that.
The college programs. Who's the guy who did The Twilight Zone?
Oh.
Rod Serling. I've heard that he was a firefighter back in Ohio in college at Antioch. Bruce Springsteen's son. Last year just graduated from the Fire Academy, certified Firefighter 1.
Do kids still say when they're 8 and 9 years old, I want to grow up and be a firefighter, Bill?
I had a cousin of mine who I grew up with sent me an email the other day, not long ago, and he said his grandson, Joey, was 8 years old and he wanted to be a fireman. And he connected him with me so that I could just send him some memorabilia and things of that nature from our hometown and so on, so that he could have a better understanding of what this is all about. So, by far.
We're getting into some of the warmer weather. Are we more likely to have fires in spring and summer than perhaps, and I'm thinking of people's...
Different kinds of fires.
Grills, catching fire, that kind of thing.
Grills, dry grass in the woods, the leaves, the parks taken off. We were talking about some of that before we came in here. Nature preserves and national parks.
Yep.
As things get kind of hotter and drier, I guess.
Drier is really the issue, and then people will be coming out more, so you have that intervention of the person into the environment, and the next thing you know, you have fires.
The true culprit, right?
culprit.
Is the person.
Man, woman, child.
Are we going to be able to address this shortage, do you think, Bill?
I think that...
It's going to take time,
I think
like.
That we have to recognize that it can't be done the way it was years ago. There's a different model that you have to adopt, and you have to think outside the box. And those that do that are successful. Those that don't do that have greater problems or don't survive.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Thank you for your work as volunteer firefighters as well. Bill Genoway is a program director of the Firemen's Association of the State of Pennsylvania's Recruitment and Retention Program, also board president of the Congressional Fire Services Institute and former King of Prussia fire chief. And Bill Genoway, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. George DeVault was a volunteer firefighter for 30 years in Lehigh County. That's in Pennsylvania, 1982. To 2012, wrote a new memoir. It also includes some interesting history called Fire Call, Sounding the Alarm to Save Our Vanishing Volunteers. George DeVault, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank
Radio
you, Marty.
Times. You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Lots of response and reaction to the program, so I'm sure there's much going on social media. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.